Hello, this is Micro News, the podcast where Matt and I
Hello.
Talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news this month. You all know the drill by now, so I think let's jump straight into it. Matt, do you want to kick us off?
I will. Now, you probably know that plants have a symbiotic relationship with a fungi, which helps nutrition and soil chemistry. Almost all crop plants form associations with a particular type of fungi, arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi. This association expands their root surface area, boosting the plant's ability to take up nutrients. This relationship is incredibly important, as the more nutrients plants can obtain naturally, the less artificial fertilizers are needed. Therefore, the more scientists can learn about the process, the more benefits for agricultural productivity. A study in PLOS Biology is trying to do just that. Researchers use the bright red pigments found in beetroot, called betalains, to track soil fungi as they colonise plant roots in a living plant. It's an amazing bit of ingenuity, as scientists can follow how the relationship between the fungi and plant root develops in real time. Joint senior author Dr. Sebastian Shornack explains how much of a leap forward this is, saying we previously had no idea about what happened because there was no way to visualize it in a living plant without the use of elaborate microscopy. The researchers engineered two model plant species, a legume and a tobacco plant, so they would produce the highly visible betalain pigments when arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi were present in their roots. They combined the control regions of two genes activated by mycorrhizal fungi with genes that synthesize red-coloured betalain pigments. The plants were then grown in a transparent medium so that the root system was visible, and images of the roots could be taken with a flatbed scanner without disturbing the plants. This meant that researchers could select red-pigmented parts of the root system and observe the interaction in real time. They looked at the fungi forming elaborate tree-like structures called arbuscules, which grow inside the plant's roots. Arbuscules take up nutrients from the soil that would otherwise be beyond the reach of the plant. Understanding and exploiting the interaction between plant and fungi has potential to enhance future crop production more sustainably. If plants can take up more nutrients naturally, this will reduce the need for artificial fertilisers, saving money and could reduce water pollution.
A story in The Guardian this month discussed the impact a warming climate might have on mosquito populations and, as a result, the mosquito-borne infectious diseases malaria and dengue fever. Researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine investigated how a warming climate could impact the breeding season of mosquitoes. They found that in 50 years, if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at their current rate, the transmission season for malaria could increase by over a month, and the transmission season for dengue would increase by 4 months every year. These changes would put an additional 4.7 billion people under threat of these two diseases. Added to those already under threat, this would mean 8 billion people would be at risk. The diseases have serious impacts on global public health, with over 400,000 deaths from malaria every year, most of which are in children, and dengue infecting an estimated 400 million a year, killing 20,000. Already, resurgence of malaria is being seen in some countries, including Colombia and Sudan, and reports of dengue fever have increased eightfold in the past 20 years. Whilst reducing emissions is the most effective way to avoid these projections, these models are an important tool for public health specialists to predict where outbreaks of mosquito-borne diseases might occur and prepare in advance. It's also worth noting that although there is currently no approved malaria vaccine, trials are ongoing. And we have even discussed some of the promising results in this area on some past episodes of Micronews. The models assumed that the current control measures would stay exactly the same, whilst, as we know, research advancements into vaccines and disease prevention will be a key way to help mitigate disease outbreaks and pandemics going forward.
So, Laura, are you aware that Lake Superior holds an incredible 10% of the world's fresh water?
I was not aware of that.
It's an unbelievable amount, and it's usually known for its purity, but not at the moment. Scientists are pretty worried, as in the last few years, there have been an increasing number of blue-green algal blooms. Now, blue-green algae isn't actually algae. It's a term used to describe the group cyanobacteria. Blue-green algae blooms are pretty easy to spot. They often look like thick pea soup or green paint floating on the surface of the water. They can be smelly and they also can be toxic. It's not unheard of for dogs to die if they swim in water with a bloom. There have been a few anecdotal reports of blue-green algae on Lake Superior, but the first confirmed bloom was in 2012. There was another huge bloom in 2018, and of course the bloom happening now. So why are the blooms happening? Well, to understand that, you have to understand how blue-green algae grows. In order to bloom, it needs nutrients, especially phosphorus. Nutrients will naturally work their way into the lake off the surrounding land. This is usually a fairly slow process, but in extreme rain, huge amounts of nutrients get washed into the lake, massively increasing the lake's phosphorus content. Both 2012 and 2018 experienced extreme rain, which could account for the blooms. The other factor is water temperature. Blue-green algae thrives in warm water. Scientists know that blooms tend to happen in years that have warm springs. The combination of these factors are worrying, as with climate change, extreme rain and warmer temperatures are going to be much more common. Lake Superior is one of the world's fastest warming lakes. Summer surface water temperatures in the lake have increased by 5 degrees over the past 30 years. So obviously something needs to be done, and scientists are prioritising finding out as much as possible about what causes algal blooms in the lake. They're focusing on the rivers that feed into the lake, as they believe that, as well as nutrients, these rivers also carry tiny cells called propagules into the lake, and they are needed to get bigger blooms started. The hope is that if scientists can pinpoint exactly what's happening, then land managers can do things like erosion control to limit the amount of material that flows into the lake and, hopefully, stop these blooms from growing.
In some more worrying news from across the pond, the US's Center for Disease Control has identified two outbreaks of a fungal disease that is resistant to all existing antifungal drugs. The fungus, called Candida auris, has been seen in Texas and Washington, D.C. Candida auris is a relatively new species and was first identified in Japan in 2009. It causes a disease called candidiasis, which is more commonly known as a yeast infection. There are a few Candida species which are able to infect people and cause candidiasis, colonizing the mouth, genitals, or skin, and in severe cases, invading the bloodstream and attacking the nervous system, muscles, organs, and even the eyes. 30 to 60% of people with invasive bloodstream Candida auris infections die, and with limited antifungal treatment options, infection with this fungus is incredibly serious. According to federal health officials in the US, Candida auris has spread widely during the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic due to an increased burden on surveillance and control bodies. This year, 5 of the 120 recorded cases of Candida auris were completely resistant to all treatment available. These people had reportedly never received antifungal drugs in the past, suggesting that they had acquired a fully resistant variant of the fungus, rather than it becoming resistant through treatment. This is a sobering reminder that antimicrobial resistance is increasing quickly, and just 12 years after its discovery, Candida auris has become a serious threat to public health with no treatment options.
The deep sea is one of the toughest places on Earth to live, and deep sea hydrothermal vents are some of the toughest in the deep sea. They're characterized by darkness, high pressure, and often high concentrations of toxic substances. Researchers from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology are looking into how the deep sea gutless tube worm and the symbiotic bacteria that live with them survive in this tough environment. Tube worms are commonly found in extreme environments. They owe their survival and fast growth to symbiotic sulfide oxidizing bacteria that live inside their body. They rely on these bacteria as they don't have a digestive system. The bacteria live in a specialised internal organ called a trophosome, and the symbiotic relationship is obviously successful, but we weren't sure why. Researchers have now decoded the genome of a deep sea gutless tube worm, Paraescarpia echinospica, and the genome of its symbiotic bacteria. The tube worm was collected at 1,400 metres below sea level. This is the first time this has been done, And the researchers have said that the discovery lays the foundation for potential applications such as nutrient generation, biomaterial production, and microbial growth control. The team discovered that the bacteria is incredibly versatile and, as well as sulfur, can use thiosulfate, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen as alternative energy sources. It's evolved elaborate strategies to distract the host's immune system, as well as the host's genome being remodeled to aid symbiosis. The host creates enzymes to digest the symbionts for nutrients and also keeps the bacteria to the most optimal level by having a programmed cell death pathway. The team hopes that this study will help advance knowledge of other marine species and open up new avenues of study, such as potentially using the unique enzymes for biomaterial production or designing strategies for microbial growth control.
And my final story is about some research that was published in the Microbiology Society's own International Journal of Systematic and Evolutionary Microbiology this month. As you know, Matt, IJSEM is the go-to place to report newly identified species of bacteria, archaea, and protists. And listeners who are interested in finding out more about the new microbes and the places that they were found, I would definitely recommend you check out our monthly New to Science blog on the Society's website. Now, you would expect new microorganisms to be discovered in faraway, inaccessible places that people haven't looked at before. But this month, an interesting new species of bacteria was discovered in an artificial lab-built ecosystem, and it can tell us more about how to sustain natural real-world ecosystems. By using a pioneering cultivation strategy to recreate the ecosystem of Red Sea mangroves, researchers in Saudi Arabia have discovered two new species of bacteria, which they named Mangrovi virga cuniculi and Caustia mangrovi. The team's key challenge was to recreate the complex mangrove environment in lab conditions. This was needed so bacteria could be grown in their natural setting. It was really complicated because of the fine balance of nutrients, vitamins, environmental conditions, and interactions between microorganisms that are required to make an ecosystem what it is. The two new bacteria required very specific conditions for their growth, and it would be impossible to culture them independently in a lab otherwise. Understanding the microbial makeup of the mangrove ecosystem is really important. Mangroves are one of the most prominent coastal ecosystems, making up almost 70% of the world's tropical and subtropical coastlines, giving home to a range of wildlife and protecting against erosion and coastal surges. Knowing best what a healthy mangrove looks like will support future conservation efforts.
That's it for this month. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. As usual, we'll leave the links to all the stories in the podcast description. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.